Welcome to Sacred Realms. It's a great day in Hyrule, y'all. Welcome to Sacred Realms, a Zelda retrospective podcast. I'm your host, Lyndon Willoughby. I'm joined on this muggy Texas evening by my co-host, Matt Willoughby. It's just creeping towards spring right now, isn't it?
It is deciding whether or not it wants to be spring. We're in that bipolar phase of Texas weather where we had 80 degree days last week and then it like snap froze over the weekend and now it's gross and semi-rainy, and it is really playing havoc on my sinuses, allergies, and I woke up this morning with a little bit of a migraine, and I'm just really over it. I'm ready for the weather to make a decision and go one direction or the other.
Are you on the struggle bus, Matt?
I'm not so much anymore. I work for a really great company, and I just texted my boss this morning and told her what was up, and she was like, go back to bed. If you can work today, great. If not, I cover it for you. Don't worry about it. So I slept until about noon today.
And then you woke up and played Destiny.
I actually didn't play Destiny. I played like 5 minutes of Destiny and then did actually end up going back to work because working in logistics and e-commerce, something happens every day where it's just like, God damn it, gotta deal with this now. So I had one of those moments with one of my clients, and so I went back to work. But no, I'm feeling pretty okay right now. It was a day. It was a day. It felt like a Monday, but it's not. It's a Tuesday.
Well, your day might have been a day, but I hope that your evening can at least become an evening.
I am very excited about this evening. Before we get too far into it, I just wanted to say that this weekend we happened to hear about the passing of Lance Reddick, who was a big star in a lot of things, and particularly in our lives, Lyndon, as Commander Zavala of Destiny. That's been kind of one of the most recent passings on of an actor who's been big in the world. Sad day. So just wanted to briefly say that we're very supportive of all the communities and of anyone dealing with loss. We'll miss Lance very much. Commander Zavala, rest in peace. And anyway,
yeah,
that's been heavy on our mind over the last couple of days.
Yeah, condolences to his family. It's so strange because obviously there are a lot of different fandoms who appreciate the work of Lance Reddick. You know, obviously to us, he's Commander Zavala from Destiny and has been from day one, right? So that's 10 years spent with a really great character and with an excellent performance. Mm-hmm. And so obviously it hits us pretty hard from that perspective. It hits me in an interesting and unique way because, you know, the entire studio was really feeling pretty broken up about this on Friday. Our game doesn't necessarily have a main character, but if it did, it would probably be Commander Zavala. So, Friday was a rough day, and it's weird how the passing of somebody that you don't actually know can make you feel emotional mm-hmm. in that way. And this was one of the ones that actually hit me a little harder. And I'm sure that people who are fans of the Horizon series feel a similar way. People who are, you know, fans of the John Wick series
or The Wire.
The Wire. Yeah. I mean, that one's going back way far. I mean, people say that's one of the best TV series of all time. So, look, you can't say that this guy didn't have an impressive career. And wasn't just incredibly talented. I mean, like, what a distinctive voice.
He was instantly recognizable in anything that he did, whether it be by his physical presence or just his voice alone. Very distinguished, very recognizable, talented, very talented. I thought his portrayal of an African descent person in John Wick, with the inflection that he gave and the accent that he created for that character. I actually read an article where he talked about the process by which he decided to create an accent for that character. And he was kind of on the fence about it, but decided at the last minute to dive in. And it's been, you know, iconic for that character for the last mm-hmm. four movies. And just so talented and such young, 60 years old. That's as old as Dad.
Yeah. You hate to hear it. You really do. It seems like it was kind of of a surprise. But I mean, yeah, it's, you know, you start hearing a lot of stories crop up about these people in situations like this. And we already knew that Lance Reddick was very involved with the Destiny community on social media, you know, doing like fan recordings and Commander Zavala's voice, but just saying like, you know, like goofy things for fun and just interacting with the community in like a really positive and fun way. And was also a big fan of the game himself and played it quite a lot. You know, there have been accounts that have been popping up on socials all weekend of like Destiny devs who, you know, Lance hit them up and was just like, hey, I'm having trouble clearing this thing.
Can you help me out?
yeah. And like just hopped in, like he was just any old person, you know, just wanted to play the game and have fun. So those are the stories that you really like to hear. Those are the things that, you know, in sad situations, you latch on to things that sound happy and that gave people joy, that brought people joy, and you just kind of run with that. And that's what you go forward with. That's what you have to do. That's how this whole mortality thing works. So yeah. Anyway, all that is to say, I hate to start the podcast on kind of a downer note. And obviously this is not a Destiny podcast, but Destiny is a big part of Matt's and my lives. And, you know, I actually also Max's life, you know, obviously. And, it's a show that's very, very close. It's a game that's very close to our hearts. And so, yeah, it felt very appropriate to say, you know, rest in peace, Lance Reddick. And let's have a toast real quick to our Vanguard commander.
To Commander Zavala. Rest in peace. Be brave, good sir.
Commander Zavala. All right. Well, with that being said, I mean... Golly.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, people are probably curious. We're I know last time we were on, we said we were both not partaking of the alcohols. And while we toast to the wonderful Lance Reddick, we are still not drinking the alcohols today. Wonderful coffee. Coffee is never a bad choice.
Coffee and cigar pairing. Yeah, absolutely. I've been I have not cracked yet on my no drinking during the week rule.
The only time that I have was I technically have a... what is it? No, it was like, it's like a no school night policy, I think. And where was I? I think I was somewhere on Thursday night where I did have a drink and then I just substituted it with like not drinking that Saturday or something.
Oh, there you
and
go.
So, yeah, but I have also so far.
Look at you shifting things around.
Yeah. Being flexible is, you know, setting goals, setting and attaining goals. There's something I learned from my wonderful girlfriend is attainable goals are what's important, right? And so don't like set yourself some goal that you're never going to be able to achieve or like not realistically going to be able to achieve. Like push yourself to do something hard, but don't be unrealistic about it. And like we obviously have a very active social life. So that was just, it kind of turned into a no school, it turned from a no school night thing to a only drinking 2 days out of the week. And, you know, as much as possible, not during the work week unless something comes up. So, so far, with that minor fluctuation, been keeping good track of it. And I feel so much better. I've definitely lost a couple of pounds. And while that not being the primary goal is a big contributing factor to feeling better. So, you know, all good things, I would say.
Absolutely.
It's wonderful.
Feeling better is always nice, you know, mm-hmm. when you can like measure that and be like, you know what? Yes, I feel healthier. That's a great, great feeling.
I sleep a little better, wake up with a little more energy, have more energy throughout the day. Like those are tangible things that are immediate benefits.
All of that sounds good.
Absolutely.
No downsides there. Well, good. Good to know that you're feeling great, Matt. I am feeling much the same way. What's got me feeling even better is that we are here tonight to talk about another section of a Zelda game. We are continuing our journey in A Link Between Worlds and continuing to have a fantastic time with it, which is, you know, which I'm always happy to report, right? Like I'm always worried going back and replaying some of these games that I haven't played in a while that we're going to come to a point where I'm realizing that's like, oh, I made this game into a bit more than it really is in my memory or something. And
yeah,
you hate for that to happen and it's not happening. So
no, absolutely. And obviously this being my first experience with the game, I would say much the same thing. You know, I'm having a really great time with it. And as the 50% of this podcasting duo that has less love for the top downs, I would say I am thoroughly enjoying my time with this game. It really has been a wonderful little game that we've been playing, and I really I haven't ever found myself trudging through a section, right? And like sometimes you can get there, just whether you've played it a lot recently or you're playing it on a time crunch or something. It's like feels almost like a chore, but never once has this game felt like that. And it's been really, really fun. So, yeah, I think and then another pretty good section today, I would say.
Absolutely. I do just want to note real quick that we originally were going to have a guest on the show tonight, Amanda from Zelda Minute. Amanda from Zelda Weekly, who also, you know, has her videos featured frequently on Zelda Universe Weekly, in fact. Right.
Yeah.
Turns out that's the title of her show. Amanda was going to come on and guest for the first time on this episode. We were going to talk about the Swamp Palace. Unfortunately, schedules conflicted, as they sometimes do. We had to make other arrangements. So we are talking with Amanda right now about a good time to bring her back and to have a makeup appearance, because we were definitely very excited to have her on. And, you know, definitely are looking for any good opportunity to kind of shake up our recurring roster of guests, especially on seasons like this. The top-down seasons tend to have quite a lot of episodes, mm-hmm. right? Like the games themselves don't tend to be too super long, but they have more dungeons. And since we talk about dungeons weekly,
yep.
these tend to be longer seasons.
For sure. And that lends itself to more guest appearances, which we appreciate. That's one of the great things I think that we bring to the diverse universe of Zelda podcasts is a group of excellent hosts who have opinions other than Lyndon's and mine, which you get to hear every week anyway. So we know you get tired.
Y'all got to be so tired of our opinions.
You've got to be tired of listening to us talk. So we like to bring other people around for you to listen to them instead, because they're generally better. So, you know, just we will find time to have Amanda back, and looking forward to getting some fresh perspectives in here. I just think it'll be fun. So, I don't know, Lyndon. I think this spin has gone on for, like 10 minutes now. You think we're good to get at some housekeeping and start trucking along?
I think you're probably right. Way to shoe us along here, Matt.
Yeah, that's what I do. I'm a business manager. I keep things moving forward.
All right. Well, Matt really wants to get into the housekeeping. I know it's his favorite part of the show. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because I always do the housekeeping. Yeah.
Do you want to do the housekeeping?
I mean, if you'll give me the script, I don't have the script. I can do the housekeeping.
I don't know if I'm willing to give up that power.
Well, fine. All right. I do have the plot recap today again. So.
Well, there you go. It evens out. Actually, it doesn't. You still have more words.
Way more words. Making it sound so like many
the
more
plot
words.
Recap is like an equivalent endeavor to the housekeeping. Is just
yeah. You have your pre-scripted that never changes, and I have to write one of these every week. And
patently untrue statement by me. So
yeah, there you go.
Sorry about that.
All right. Well, you do your thing, and okay. I'll do my thing.
All right. If you didn't know, Sacred Realms is a weekly re-examination of The Legend of Zelda, one little slice at a time. Sacred Realms drops every Wednesday and is available on all major podcast networks. Every week, we play a new section of a Zelda game. Then we sit down here to talk and to drop our hot takes. If that sounds fun to you, please head over to Apple Podcasts, hit that subscribe button, and be sure to leave us a review. 5-star reviews are greatly appreciated, and they have a chance to get a shout out here on the show. If you want more Sacred Realms in your life, you can head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod to get access to our Discord channel, listener mail, vote on what game we play next, and much more. Additionally, one of the benefits that Master Sword patrons and above get is that we read their names every week here on the show. Those legendary individuals are Shepherd Street, Matthew, Chris, Daniel, Fallout 907, Kelso, Tiffany the Star, Daxel, Patrice, Stephanie, Darknuck, Brian, George, Mike, Dylan, Allie, Lennon, Melanie, Kolku, Aiden, Rowan, Joshua, Nick, Dante, Gep, Brittany, Davey, Haru the Mighty, Derek, Albert, Mark, Andy, Cameron, Ben, Daniel, NickD_TV, Travis, Christian, Jonathan, Hyrule Interviews, a.k.a. Max Nichols, Garrett, and Drew. These are the most legendary of individuals. I would accompany them into yet another water dungeon any day of the week.
Our first water dungeon in a while, and the way you said Garrett and you looked at me, I was like, are you asking me a question of whether or not Garrett is a patron or
no,
not?
No,
I don't know. But
I was adding some dramatic enunciation.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You're doing the dramatic pause.
This is a craft, Matt. And if you don't, if you don't practice your craft,
really,
then you lose it.
Yeah. Well, you haven't practiced a plot recap in a while, so maybe I'll make you do it next week because I think you're getting a little rusty.
I do a plot recap next week.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. You do the plot recap next week, and I'll do all the housekeeping.
Deal.
We'll see who does it better.
Cool.
Voting poll in the Discord next week after Lyndon's reappearance on the plot recap.
Well, now there's like pressure associated with this. And I don't know if I like that, but I've already committed and said yes, so I'm not going to back out now. I'm going to do the honorable thing and abide by my word.
Otherwise, I'll throw the gauntlet down, Lyndon, and we'll just have it out right now.
What does that mean? What does that entail?
That's like ancient knight chivalry code for duel.
No, I know what it means, but like in this specific circumstance of us recording a podcast at my house, what would it entail?
I don't know. It's like I'll wrestle you. I don't know. It was metaphoric, Lyndon. We're not actually doing it. I hadn't thought that far ahead.
I don't want to do that.
Well, fine.
Okay.
Well, we're not. So there you go.
Cool. I win again.
Oh, wow. All right. We're going to have to talk
about that. Without further ado, let's talk about what we play. It's the power of being the host. I can just roll right through whatever you're saying at any given time. Without further ado, let's talk about what we played. We do that, of course, every week in the Sacred Realms Rundown, which is a 6-part analysis of what we played this week and the feelings that it made us feel. Today, we are covering A Link Between Worlds, Chapter 5. Our dungeon is the Swamp Palace. Part 1 of the Sacred Realms Rundown is, as always, the plot recap this week, read by Matt. Take it away, Matt.
I actually have it done in time this week.
I'm so proud of you.
As we talked about last week, did
Mike giving you crap about it on our last episode really hold your feet to the fire?
No, it's the fact that we're recording on a Tuesday and this episode goes live tomorrow. That's what held my feet to the fire. With one sage saved and 6 more to go, we set out to find our next dungeon within Lohruul. But as we travel around Lohruul, we find our way mostly blocked outside of the Dark Palace region. Remembering Hilda's warning about much of Lohruul being separated by impassable chasms, we head back to Hyrule through one of the dimensional rifts. Once we arrive back in the land we grew up in, we decide to visit our master and his wife to let them know that Gully is safe. While they are very reassured, they still miss their son and hope for his return quickly. Before departing the shop, however, the blacksmith notices the master sword we carry, as well as the piece of master ore that we discovered inside the Dark Palace. He tells us that if we are able to find another piece of master ore, he can use it to temper the master sword into a stronger blade. We head off towards home again and use some of the riches we have gathered along the way to purchase some items from Ravio. Then we head to Mother Mayamai to drop off some of her wayward kiddos and upgrade an item or two in the process. From Mother Mayamai's cave, we head directly to the west, into the marshy area by Lake Hylia. While exploring, we find another dimensional rift in the area and head back to Lohruul. Here we find what has to be the Swamp Palace that Hilda mentioned, but the path is blocked by an extremely large stone that our bombs and hammer can't even scratch. We need to find a way to get past this obstacle, so we start exploring the region around the swamp. Between the swamp and the thieves' village, we see a truly huge bomb flower behind a gate next to an odd-looking house. We enter the house to find what must be some kind of mad scientist who is singing to himself, and then to us, about his bomb flower. Getting past all the musical numbers, he tells us he is renting out the bomb flower for just 200 rupees. So we head into the yard and get the semi-sentient bomb flower to follow us around. We do have to use it to blow open the entrance to the yard, but luckily another one pops up right in its place. We take this second bomb for a stroll, and while studiously avoiding getting hit by literally anything, we make our way back to the Swamp Palace. The gigantic explosive does the trick, and the path is open. However, the moat that we planned to swim over drains away into a nearby grate, leaving a gap that we can't jump. Luckily, we have a handy tool that we rented from Ravio. The hookshot allows us to grab onto a wooden post on the other side of the chasm and pull ourselves over. The Swamp Palace is a dungeon that reeks of rotting foliage, damp and stagnant pools, and crawls with dangerous critters that seem commonplace within Lohruul. We quickly find that the useful hookshot will be the key to traversal through this watery palace, as we use it to cross chasms, pull switches from afar, and use its strong chain to pull other switches throughout the dungeon that raise and lower the water level of certain rooms. While the dungeon only has 2 main floors, each floor has many levels that require cunning to explore to their fullest. The keys are hidden in hard-to-reach places, and all over each floor we are accosted by a variety of enemies, like the Tektites that skate along the surface of the water, the electrified floating Bari, and water sprites that come out of the swamp out of the swampy pool to attack us. As we delve deeper and deeper into the dungeon, we come across a truly ginormous Bari that unlocks the fast travel point back to the entrance for us once defeated. Further into the dungeon, we come to a room that contains a switch, much like the one we saw in the main room. By pulling it in one direction, we can drain the water level enough to reach the room in the very center of the dungeon, which contains an extremely powerful set of blue mail for us to don. This magical armor cuts any damage taken in half and will serve as a vital lifeline while exploring the dangerous land of Lohruul. Back in the main room of the palace, we find the chest containing the boss key surrounded by fire, and we use the tornado rod to extinguish the flames long enough to open the chest and claim the big key. Making our way to the far end of the room, we find a switch hidden creepily under a skull and are astonished as it raises a platform from the basement to prop up stairs leading right to the boss door. We head inside to find a completely closed-off circular room with water up to our ankles. As we step into the room, a huge octopus creature drops suddenly from the ceiling. Along with the creature are a collection of a dozen or so eyeballs, completely separate from the monster and encased in swamp water. As we scramble around the small room, we find enough time to whip out the hookshot and grapple one of the eyes out of the protective sheath of water so that we can destroy it with our sword. As we do this over and over again, the octopus continues to try to trample us or jump on top of us in this confined space. Once the final of the bodiless eyeballs is destroyed, Argus really starts going after us with a vengeance. It starts leaping swiftly around the room and occasionally stopping in midair to try to blast us with a laser beam. As the superheated water erupts around us, we have to quickly use the opportunity to shoot the monster with our bow and arrow to damage it. After an interminable and exhausting amount of time spent dodging this beast's various attacks, it finally falls to our barrage of arrows and explodes in glorious fashion. As it does, it drops a heart container and opens a door in the back wall of the room. We head through and find the portrait of the beautiful Zora Queen, Orin, there waiting for us. We touch the painting and are taken once again to the Chamber of the Sages. Orin thanks us for saving her once again, and laments that she cannot repay us for the help as she was unable to do before. The only repayment she can give us is the advice to save the rest of the sages and to do so quickly. The power she will bring to bear on our behalf against the fusion of the Demon King and Yuga will be payment enough for all, so we take the portal out of the Chamber of the Sages and back to Lohruul to continue our quest. Elsewhere, in Lohruul Castle, Princess Hilda sits in her imprisonment within the castle. While she is using all her might to keep the Demon King contained, her only company is the portrait of her Hylian counterpart, Princess Zelda. She laments to the only soul that can hear the sorrows of her kingdom and of her crown. She laments that her kingdom is no longer like that of Hyrule, where endings are happy and the land is blessed. As she entrusts these sorrows to Zelda's portrait, she hopes aloud that we have the strength required to succeed in this most desperate endeavor and to save both of their kingdoms.
This has been the plot recap as read by Matt. Let's get into part two, which is our takes where we talk about this section of the game and how it made us feel. You know, what I want to say before we get into talking about the dungeon or anything else, Matt, is that so what I noticed kind of traversing Lohruul, which I spent a lot more time doing this week than I did in the lead up to the Dark Palace. I really didn't explore Lohruul too much in that episode. And this week I really kind of did a lot of poking around. And what I was noticing is that this game has a very interesting way of making that initial steep difficulty spike stick. Right.
Right.
Like Lohruul is still a very lethal place. There's nothing that we've acquired since getting there that is really helping our survivability much, aside from whatever heart containers you could be kind of going out of your own way to grab. But the thing is, even with that being said, and again, you have to remember I'm talking from a hero mode perspective here.
Sure. And that's quadruple damage, but regular heart rate drops.
Yes. Yeah. Even with that, I mean, one extra heart is just truly not helping you too much. I'm trying to think how many hearts I had. The little crabs who hang out outside the Swamp Palace.
Yeah, they probably do a hell of a lot of damage to
very close to one hit. And it's weird because...
Well, don't get hit by a Hinox.
Yeah, the Hinox are one hit, at least at the amount of health that I had. But it's very interesting because some enemies do like drastically more damage in low rule and others do, you know, just a little bit less, more like four or six hearts. It's kind of tough to tell like which is going to be which, you know, you sort of don't know until you get bumped by one.
Yeah.
Which is scary. But yeah, I mean, I think that what's really nice is that like we've had games that we played where we've had a very gradual difficulty climb, and we've had games where it was easy, 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 and then all of a sudden, oh my god, I want to die, right? Like
yeah, like Zelda 2.
Yeah, well, no, Zelda 2 was always hard. I was thinking
always want to die.
I was thinking more like the OG, The Legend of Zelda, was not a super difficult game
for sure
until, you know, until some point, I can't remember if it was dungeon like 4 or 5, but at some point it really just kind of like started hitting you over the face. but Zelda games can be like that. It's like the difficulty scaler, I guess, is not consistent across this entire series. Some games do it better than others. And
so I want to pause there for a second because I'm thinking back to difficulty scalers within games, and the ones that get really hard really fast are almost all 2D games. Am I wrong about that? Because like I'm trying to think of a 3D game that
Breath of the Wild.
Well, yeah, but Breath of the Wild is kind of as difficult as you make it based on where you explore. So it doesn't have to be a difficulty ramp unless you go to dangerous places.
I mean,
first.
Great Plateau is a dangerous place in Breath of the Wild before you can leave. I mean, with three hearts and just like, I mean, especially, okay.
Like, look, in master mode, yes.
But even the first time you ever, like, we've both played Breath of the Wild a ton. Sure. I died a lot on the Great Plateau the first time I ever played Breath of the Wild, you know?
I'm having a hard time. That was 7 years ago. I'm having a hard time remembering that. But
the first time you played Breath of the Wild was not 7 years ago.
It came out 7 years ago.
It was in 2017.
Linden. We've talked about how long it's been between Zelda game releases multiple times. Hold on. Zelda Breath of the Wild.
March of 2017, which I guess is actually it is going on 7 years.
Yeah, March of 2017. So 6 years. It was 6 years ago. And look, I've slept since then. Like, look, right. And I've played a lot of video games since then. And like, yeah, I guess you're probably right. Breath of the Wild to one side, though, because it's kind of unique. I'm trying to think of another like Ocarina of Time or Skyward Sword or Wind Waker or even Twilight Princess. Like, I don't remember Twilight Princess quite as well, but
so just
the difficulty ramp, like enemies don't necessarily hit harder in those games until you get to like bigger enemies like Darknuts or Stalfos normally. Right. And I'm trying to remember where those difficulty scalers really come into play for 3D games, and it doesn't seem as drastic as it normally is in 2D games. Like, am I just making something up there? And if
I think you're pretty much right. I think with 3D games, what you have happen more often is instead of enemies hitting harder, like they all do come to a point where, yes, enemies are hitting harder, right? As you get further in the game, things are hitting you for like four hearts instead of two or three or whatever. But sure. Like, I think in the 3D games, what happens more often is the further that you go into it, the more variety and enemy mechanics you're running into.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think that's kind of what I was hinting at in a non-eloquently stated way. So thank you for clarifying that, because that's kind of what I think about, right? Is when it comes to 2D Zelda games, it's enemy density and damage dealt that ramps, because there's not a lot of mechanics that are able to be put in play, right?
Right.
So it feels much more spiky as far as the ramp and difficulty.
And I will say, I'm not sure if this is just because I know that they do more damage and thus they're scaring me more, but it feels like the enemy AI in low rule, they're more aggressive than
Absolutely are. Like the Moblins are more aggressive than the Knights. The Hinox just are out for blood and their bombs explode instantly. Whereas the Knights that throw bombs in Hyrule, their bombs have a delay. and they don't do as much damage, and they're pretty confined, whereas Hinoxes chase you around while throwing bombs at you. They generally run in pairs.
Yeah.
They're terrifying. No, I think you're absolutely right. The enemy AI feels more aggressive in low rule than it does in high rule.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say that that's still just with a pretty limited sampling of the low rule map. So this week in my explorations, obviously I spent most of it in the, you know, southern area of low rule around where the dungeon is, but also spent a fair amount of time over by the, I think it's called the Thieves Village here. It's whatever.
Yes, that's correct.
It's whatever the ruined village is. And then also in and around low rule castle, because, I'll talk about this a little bit more in Bloopy Trails, but there was an area of the map that I spent a lot of time trying to find a way into for a specific reason. I'll get to that later. But, you know, a lot of more difficult enemies in there as well. But I know that there are even harder sections where the enemies are like even more lethal than that. I mean, just wait until we get up onto Death Mountain.
Yeah, that's going to be terrifying.
It's nuts up there. We've got like, I can tell you right now, there are low rule equivalents of like the Hinox and, or sorry, not the Hinox,
the Lynels.
The Lynel up there.
Woof.
In addition to just like tankier and more deadly versions of the Hinox and Tektites and things like that. And yeah, Death Mountain's a pretty insane place. So all that is to say that I was on my toes the entire time that I was exploring, and I did do a lot of exploring in low rule this week, for my eyes, certainly, but also just spent a lot of time poking around, like trying my hand at mini games, you know, did this whole thing with the giant bomb flower, obviously, which if you kind of do everything that you can do with it requires a few different trips.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just spent a lot more time poking around this new overworld and really enjoying that time and how difficult it was.
Yeah, I didn't explore too terribly much. I did quite a bit with the big bomb flower, and there were a couple of places that I didn't hit with the bomb flower. I was trying to just get to the dungeon, but I'm definitely going to be going and doing that a lot, because the couple of places that I did open up with the big bomb flower had some pretty neat stuff in them, including the great fairy, the great rupee fairy.
There are three by my count, but I don't remember off the top of my head if there are any more than that. We'll see if we find any more as we explore. But I think there's only three, but I could be wrong about that. One of the things that it is really showing me, though, is that like even though some of the main reasons for exploring this map are just like one, rupee collection, because we do have a good reason to be doing that in this game. And then two, looking for Maimais, you know, the exploration is still a lot of fun and never really got old for me, even though the path from the last dungeon to this dungeon is pretty stinking direct.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there are obstacles to getting to some of these low rule dungeons that we get to later. Like, again, going back to Death Mountain, there's a whole lot of like map traversal through caves and stuff that has to happen for that, you know? And that is not the case here. Like the Swamp Palace, even more so than the Dark Palace, is probably the most easily accessible of all of these low rule dungeons.
Yeah. There's not a lot you have to do to get in there. And, I think, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that's part of just the fact that this game has, 12-ish dungeons, and it's just trying to kind of move you along at a clip so that you're not getting bogged down too much.
I want to say it's a neutral thing, and in another game, I would say maybe it was intentional, right? Like, in a game where it has a fixed dungeon order, this would be the kind of thing where it's like, okay, well, if Swamp Palace is supposed to be the first one that you go to, you know, which again, if this game had a fixed dungeon order, this would be the dungeon that is closest to where you first pop out in low rule, right?
Yeah, it's right below your house.
And there's no crevices or anything that you have to kind of find your way around.
It's kind of the main area, right? Like the main area of low rule really consists of the castle, your mirror house and the blacksmith's area and Thieves Town and the Swamp Palace are all like in this weird peninsula looking place. Kind of the mainish area, I guess. I would assume that a lot of people would probably find this one first or close to first. Maybe they find Thieves Hideout first just because it's in Thieves Town, which would probably be a pretty quick stop for most people.
Right.
Like it's probably one of those two. And, you know, I remember Thieves' Palace and A Link to the Past was one of our last ones because it was fairly difficult, mm-hmm. at least in A Link to the Past, and things were more linear in A Link to the Past anyway. So, actually, funny story. I opened Thieves' Hideout this week on accident.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did.
That's awesome.
So I walked in there and I was like, wait.
Nope, got to come back.
And, like, I thought it was just like a little... mini dungeon thing that I would get like a little reward from, like a heart container or something, like, oh, I solved this riddle. And I walked in there and it was a whole dungeon and I was like, oh, nope, this is wrong. So I turned around and hightailed it out of there.
But that's fun. I like that this is the kind of game where, because of its structure of you just being able to basically go to any of these in any order, you can do that. You know, it's got to be a very interesting problem to tackle from a game design perspective, because it's so much less controlled than a lot of games are and a lot of Zelda games are. I'm never going to be able to see these metrics because I don't think there's any way to track this other than just like if you took a community poll
survey, yeah.
or something. But I would love to know in what order most people do the dungeons when they replay and in what order most people did the dungeons for the first time. Because the thing is, I would imagine that somebody has a very different gameplay experience in the back half of this game based on what order they do the dungeons in. For instance, somebody who does a lot of exploring and makes their way to the Ice Palace first or Turtle Rock first, right? Like if you just so happen to go do a lot of the dungeons that require a lot of time and investment and effort to get to first, and then like the last one that you happen to have left to do is Swamp Palace, and there's basically nothing required to get in there.
Yeah.
I would imagine that kind of serves to kill some momentum in the way that hypothetical person has been playing the game.
Right. Because you would theoretically want difficulty and accessibility to ramp in inversely, right? As you get to the last of the dungeons. Right. And so I think that's an interesting point. And one thing that I actually noticed this week that is kind of diving into the dungeon map a little bit is a big thing that makes this possible, the whole doing dungeons in any order, is the fact that you have access to all the items in the game right out of the bat if you want to have them rented. And that was obviously
with
not the
one
case.
With one exception.
Yes, without other than the sand rod. Without that was the way that Link to the Past kind of curated your dungeon experience. And it's interesting to me that the dungeons that we have now utilize the item primarily that you would have gotten in that dungeon, at least in this week's case, which is in A Link to the Past, the Swamp Palace is where you got the hookshot. And in this dungeon, you have to have the hookshot in order to get into the dungeon and access all of the puzzles.
So I definitely think that that's a very interesting parallel, and it's one of the many between this game and A Link to the Past. I definitely don't think that's the case for all of the dungeons in this game. But again, like, it goes back to those interesting threads that go between them, where, you know, it, like in A Link to the Past, the Dark World does have a Swamp Palace and it's in the same place as it is here.
Right? Yeah.
And we kind of said the same thing about the Dark Palace last week, and it holds true for one or two others as we go throughout the game. So that continues to be very interesting as well. But yeah, I don't know. It's so interesting. I want to put a pin in this whole like difficulty versus like freedom of exploration conversation and just say that it's an interesting give and take. I would imagine mm-hmm. like, yes, like on one hand, you lose a little bit of the controlled aspect of like the game designers taking you through a very intentional path through the game. But on the other hand, you gain freedom and you gain the ability to kind of choose your own adventure. And again, I'm just going to say that I don't think that decision is necessarily positive or negative. I think that it's completely neutral, and you know, your mileage will vary based on the path that you choose to take.
And it's very interesting that they have found a way to implement that in a top-down Zelda. Like, that's obviously something that's been implemented in 3D Zeldas, Wind Waker being an example to an extent, and Breath of the Wild being the primary example. So, like, seeing it implemented in a 2D game, I think was an interesting experiment that I'm hopeful to see as we've talked about many times, hopeful to see more top-down Zelda games, and hopefully they'll continue that kind of experimentation in those top-down Zelda games that they've been doing in the 3D Zelda games.
Well, it's,
and
like it's clear,
how can you mix up the formula to have a different experience?
It's clear that the only way to really successfully completely do that is to change the game's relationship to key items. In this case, changing the dynamic of how you acquire them, and in Breath of the Wild,
eliminating them entirely.
Yeah. Like, you know,
yeah.
Or just giving you the Sheikah slate. Like, I don't want to cast aspersions on Breath of the Wild's whole system because it's great, but it's completely
different. We know your feelings about Breath of the Wild's items.
They're your feelings too. You also ranked it number one.
Anyway, beside the point, I think it's interesting because then you get back into the conversation of, what is one of the core tenets of Zelda design? Is it exploration, or is it item acquiring and dungeon diving? Is it like you get back into that conversation, and I think you can nuance that conversation into what is the identity of a top-down Zelda game versus what is the identity of a 3D Zelda game, and are the top-downs going more for a Metroidvania realm like some of the older style games really were? And what do they want to accomplish there? And I think that there's room for, and I think that this game proves that there is room for both. There is room for the classic Metroidvania style, and there's also room for the more freeform exploration, and it can work. So interested to see where that goes in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So since this is not actually a dungeon item, kind of doing what we've been doing this entire time and talking about the main item we get this week in part two instead of in the dungeon map, how do you feel about the hookshot in this game?
It's a hookshot. Like, all the hookshots are cool.
Right. It's a top-down Zelda game.
Yeah. I do think, though, I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think this is the first time you use the hookshot in a way other than just traversal. Like, you use it to pull switches. I don't think you've ever been able to do that before.
Nothing is coming to mind. The only thing that I can think that's analogous to, like, so you're talking obviously in the dungeon this week, you use the hookshot to grasp on to chains and you can pull them.
Yep. And also the rotating switches.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the closest thing I can think to a top-down Zelda game doing something like that is in Link's Awakening, but in those you just pull the switches. You don't use the hookshot. So,
and it felt a lot like the rope in Wind Waker.
Or the whip in Skyward Sword.
Yeah, or the whip in Skyward Sword, where it's kind of doing both.
Yeah.
And that was neat. I thought that was a really cool little change that they made.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things where the hookshot is not one of the items that I typically keep glued to one of my two buttons in this game.
For sure.
I will say that the upgraded version, in my memory, I was kind of selling short how much better the upgraded version is than the non. And, you know, it's still not good enough to where going later in the game, I will keep it. Like, I think the two items that I typically keep glued to those buttons at all times are the upgraded fire rod and the bombs.
Dude, I am loving the upgraded bow.
Dude, you just wait till you get the upgraded fire rod.
I need to buy it first. It's
really
expensive.
Something. Yeah, it is. But anyway, so it's never going to be one of those. But the upgraded version, I do appreciate the faster chain travel time that it has, which is awesome, especially for like trying to collect hearts or rupees or something and not wanting to get close to other enemies.
Yeah.
Being able to stun enemies in low rule is a very, very useful thing.
Doesn't the boomerang do that too?
I don't remember. And I also, so the boomerang is also not necessary for any of the dungeons in this game.
Right.
It's just a completely optional, like, you don't have to buy it from Ravio, as far as I remember. So maybe I'll do that next week and I'll compare the two and let you know. The other thing that I completely forgot about, I don't remember, does the base version of this hookshot do damage to enemies, or does it just stun?
It does. I did not upgrade it. I did buy it from Ravio, but I didn't upgrade it at Mother Maya Mai. And it still does damage. Like, that's how I killed some of the Baris, that spawn from the big boy Bari.
Yeah, me too.
And I was actually curious what the upgrade version does, but faster chain travel time, and I guess increased damage damage probably, but it does do damage to enemies.
Okay, cool. So yeah, I mean, not much more to say about this. The hookshot is the hookshot is the hookshot. Top-down Zelda games just really don't. Yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it sort of situation, right?
I mean, that's how it is in 3Ds too. Like it's there.
Well, you
it's
say cool. that, but then like
then you in get some the double hookshot.
Well, and then sometimes it's the claw shot, and then like you get to Twilight Princess where it like truly serves no real purpose outside of like, oh, there's a target for this thing, and
yeah,
and then it's just kind of.
Although the double claw shot in Skyward Sword is a lot of fun. That is a fun traversal mechanic that I like a lot.
Yeah, well, Skyward Sword mostly, especially once you get into like the sand sea and everything, it just starts giving you a lot of really fun ways to use it.
Very George of the Jungle.
Yeah. Well, and the whole like, you know, descending and climbing on it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fun. So much fun.
That's fun. But regardless, this is not that.
This is not that. No, it is a very top-down hook shot. Yes.
Yeah, it's fine. Do you have anything else you want to say in part two before we move on and start talking about the dungeon map?
What did you think of our mad scientist friend who sang at you the whole time?
Well, I don't want to get too far ahead of Z targeting.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I thought he was a really fun and interesting guy. I will say, so let's talk about the giant bomb flower real quick, because
semi-sentient bomb flower.
That's a fun little.
I know it was, honestly.
Almost kind of a mini game, right?
It's like an escort mission, which we both hate, but it's also a very short escort mission.
Right.
So, and it's also just really funny to see a big old bomb flower hopping behind you. So that kind of gave it a little bit of humor for me.
I do love that this thing is like, does it have a consciousness? I don't know.
Does it know that it's going to its death? Is it trying to fulfill its purpose? Is it like IG-11 in Mando? I must self-destruct. No, don't self-destruct. No, I have to right now. No, don't do it.
Like until you need it.
Until you need it to. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
I like to imagine that the bomb flower behind me is just constantly doing the IG-11 bit of, should I self-destruct now? No, not yet. Should I self-destruct now? Nope. So that was kind of my headcanon. I was escorting it around the map.
I think that if this had lasted any longer, like if the path from getting it to opening up the Swamp Palace had been any longer than it was, then it might have started to annoy me. Or if the enemy density had been just a little bit more, you know, unfair then.
Or if the enemies had targeted the bomb flower as if it were another character.
And see, and that's the thing too. Mostly what you just have to do, because the enemies are still going to aggro on you.
Right.
You know?
So just keep the enemies in front of you and away from the bomb flower and you're generally going to be okay.
Yeah. I will say the one exception to that rule is, so the obviously you have to use this thing to open the Swamp Palace, but if you go further over to the right, in the same area, kind of down as far south as you can go,
and then the
off towards Lake Hylia or whatever it's called in Lorule, there is another one of these big bomb stones there, and you can get in, and it's got tons of rupees for you.
Lake Lylia?
Yeah. Lake Lylia. Sure, that's it.
Sure, we'll go with it.
Got it in one, Matt.
Yeah!
But anyway, the thing that's difficult about that, though, is that one of those flying mushroom dudes who spits fire is over there. Mm-hmm. And so and there's a few other enemies that are in a very tightly compacted space right before the stone you have to blow up. So that is one where past times that I played this game, this time I got really lucky and I got it in one try. Past times that I've played this game, I've had the bomb explode frequently, like right there at the very end.
Oof, rough. I didn't blow that one up. I did the one on the left when you right come out, that's the Great Rupee Fairy. And then I did, I guess I only did that one and then the Swamp Palace. So I think there's one other, obviously I missed that one. Isn't there one more in that area that's like higher up, or?
I'm not sure. I really don't
I don't
remember.
Know. Maybe not, but I'm vaguely remembering that I need to, next time I play, go take the bomb flower over somewhere and blow something else up. So
yeah.
Did you ever accidentally detonate it? Because I did. I accidentally did a spin attack on the shielded Moblin dude to try to kill him in one, and ended up hitting the bomb flower, which ended up working out because he ended up killing the shielded Moblin dude for me.
Yeah, but then so, you had to go back and get another bomb.
Yes, and it was annoying, but you know, meh. It is what it is.
No, I didn't do that. Well, I did it right the first time.
Well, bully for you. No one cares.
I'm sorry. That sounded accusatory. That's my bad, Matt.
It's fine. Okay. I'm just a little bitter. I'm actually not. It was fine. So yeah, that was all good. And this is just another general thing that I find. The things that you find semi-amusing and funny generally annoy me. Like the singing scientist guy. Annoying, in my opinion. Unnecessary. But,
It veered more closely to something that I think could have started grading if we spent more time having to talk to this guy, you know? Mm-hmm. We didn't, so I'm taking it for what it is. Just like a fun, quirky character that I, you know, spend 30 seconds interacting with and then it's done.
Yeah, this is something that I think Zelda has a pretty colorful hit or miss ratio on, is characters that they're going actively for comic relief. And that can sometimes work, and often, in my opinion, doesn't land. So whereas characters that are more just accidentally kind of goofy, like Darunia in Ocarina of Time, being kind of goofy with the dancing thing, like that worked. But when they're going for and actively trying for funny goofiness, I think it's a very it's a wide hit or miss for me. So
yeah, the Zelda series history with successful comedy is spotted, to say the least.
For sure, for sure.
But this one did not annoy me, I think, in the same way that it did you.
Cool.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into part three, which is the dungeon map, where we talk about this week's dungeon from mechanics to music and more. Dungeon this week is the Swamp Palace. And here we have our water temple for this game, Matt.
This is our first water temple since Skyward Sword.
Yes, it is.
Breath of the Wild doesn't really count because divine beasts are not dungeons. First water dungeon in many, many seasons.
It's so interesting, too, because I think that in order to I think it's probably a lot more difficult for a top down Zelda game to have what we would consider to be a successful water dungeon, or at least a dungeon that executes on the theme of being a water dungeon successfully in like a mechanically interesting way. Right.
It successfully executes successfully.
Yes.
That's what you said.
Yes.
By the way,
I stand by it.
OK. All right.
Cool.
There you go. Nothing but net.
How about that? Yeah,
sure. No,
but just because of the much more limited like perspective that you have.
Yeah.
You know, we have like, so Link's Awakening, for instance, has a water dungeon, Angler's Tunnel. But the only thing that really makes that a water dungeon is the fact that you have to have the flippers to swim around in it. Right. Which is fun. You know, Angler's Tunnel's never going to be. Angler's Tunnel's never going to be one of my favorite dungeons. This one, I think, executes on the premise really well, and it's able to do that just because there is power behind this game to be able to have three different levels of height within a room.
Field. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. The depth of field, which is something we've talked a lot about in a lot of dungeons, as not being a thing that is well executed in any other top-down Zelda game so far, depth of field in this game is excellent. And the ability to see what it is that is one or two levels below the water level, and being able to differentiate whether it's one or two levels below,
yeah,
is big.
Yeah.
And knowing how to, or figuring out how to get the water level where you need it to where you can reach those things, mm-hmm, is something that I don't think could even be executed on successfully until the 3DS engine, which allowed depth of field the way that it is.
Yeah.
And it is a really big triumph for top-down water dungeons, for sure.
Also, our first revisiting of being able to raise and lower the water of a dungeon by three levels, going all the way back to Ocarina of Time's water temple here.
Except much easier, because you don't have to play a song and then sit there and listen to said song.
Right. And if you mess it up, you don't have to go all the way back through the dungeon to
to find the other one that lowers it. Yeah. Man. Yeah. The versatility of the switches, doing both actions and being able to just sit in one place, like, you know, 2 feet apart, and do what you need to do, is huge. And I think was probably the main factor for making this the least annoying water dungeon that I think I've ever played.
Even more, even less annoying than Ancient Cistern? Because I wouldn't say that Ancient Cistern annoyed me in any major way.
I guess you're right. Yeah. Well, yeah, you're right. So least annoying with the mechanic of raising and lowering water. Because that didn't really have Raising and Lowering Water. You just had to open up different pathways so you could get waterfalls or cut off waterfalls.
Right, sure, yeah. So, okay, that's fair. That's fair.
I think that this was a very successful water dungeon overall. The mechanics just worked well.
And speaking to your point about the interesting visual cues and ways that it gives you of kind of telling what level the water is at without having to go back and look at the indicator on the lever, you know, there's a really nice thing that it does where there are a helpful number of platforms at various levels within the rooms. And all you have to do is kind of look and see, is this one covered? Is this one not covered?
Is the water up to where I need it to be? Yeah.
And it's very, very well telegraphed. It's the kind of thing that I think, if you don't do this the right way, then it's just frustrating, especially when you're trying to figure out the difference between, completely empty and half full.
Yep.
Right. Because when it's completely full, there's no confusion. You know, you can't get confused about where you can go because you can just kind of swim around on the top of everything, you know, but like those bottom two levels, if you don't do this right, then you can get into a situation really easy where you think you've got it at the right level, but then you walk over to like a raised platform or something and it's like, oh, I can't walk on that. I'm at the wrong level of water height, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think that this dungeon ever really had that problem. At least to me, it didn't.
No, I don't think that it did either. There was only one time where I had the water level one too high. I was trying to dive for some rupees and couldn't reach them. And I, you know, at that point realized that I needed to lower it one more. But other than that, I thought that it was very well visually telegraphed to know where you were.
Yeah. The other interesting thing about this dungeon to me is that, so actually going back to something that you were saying in your plot recap, is the fact that when you look at this dungeon from just a map layout standpoint, it doesn't look too big, right? It's only two floors. The floors are not huge. They're not sprawling. We're back to that thing we've been talking about this entire game, about how dungeon layout is pretty compact overall, just from a map standpoint. And this dungeon definitely continues that trend. However, the fact that you have this water level mechanic kind of makes it feel bigger than it actually is, because you're spending more time in a lot of these rooms than you would be otherwise.
Yeah, they capitalize on the space very well and effectively to make the dungeon more lengthy than it otherwise would have been. Another interesting mechanic that they use to do that is the switching of the waterways to create pathways that you can float across, much like you did with the airstreams. And like one room, you will either you can flow through to one side, hit the switch, then flow through to the other side and hit the switch, and then flow back to the middle. Like, I thought that was a really cool mechanic as well, to utilize a space for more than just a one puzzle and done. Yeah. Right. So definitely good capitalization of resources here.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because we haven't had the conversation in a long time about the difference between. You hear that? The rain's picking up.
It is a little bit. It's kind of nice.
I love the sound of like soft rain.
The little trickle. Yeah.
And we're underneath the awning tonight. We thought that this might happen. So we wisely, it turns out, chose to move the table under the awning so that we didn't have to do it in the middle of the episode. And now we just have this really nice little background noise, which I really appreciate. It's relaxing.
It is. It's appropriate for a water dungeon.
It is, isn't it? Anyway, we have not had a conversation in a very long time about the difference between a combat gauntlet dungeon and a puzzle box dungeon, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I think that this is 100%, according to the definition we've been going on for the longest time, definitely a puzzle box dungeon, not only because it has less second-to-second combat than a lot of other ones do. The enemy density is not huge in here.
Right. No, it's really not. Other than the water sprites that pop up and fly around, which they annoyed me in A Link to the Past as well, but more so there because their path was so erratic. What I think one change that they made to those specific enemies in this game is they spawn in the same place, they go the same direction, they do the same thing every time.
Yeah.
So they're easier to avoid, which I appreciated.
Yeah. But what this does have is that classic puzzle box situation of the main tension that you're running into is in environmental mechanics that change the dynamic of the dungeon and of specific rooms, right?
Right. Yeah, for sure. And in some cases, it Actually, you know what? It doesn't affect any other room in the dungeon, which I thought was a little weird. Like raising the water level in the main room didn't affect the water level in any of, in either of the offshoot rooms, which I thought was a little odd. I'm grateful for it in some ways because it made dungeon traversal easier so that you didn't have to constantly be thinking about what your water level was at in the main room to affect what you were doing in the side rooms. But I think that's something they could have done to have made it more puzzle boxy, because that was always kind of the main definition that we operated on with Max, was one thing you do in one room of a dungeon affects the rest of the dungeon in some way.
Right.
And like this feels like the rooms, each room itself is puzzle boxy, but it doesn't affect the wider dungeon, which was an interesting design choice. And I think probably one they made for accessibility reasons. And after some of the backlash from other water temples that are just extremely puzzle boxy, and you were constantly having to think about where your water level was at in the main room versus your side rooms. So yeah. I think that there's some design decision there that was in the benefit of the more casual player.
Yeah, well, and it really helps avoid a situation where, like we were mentioning earlier, you create unnecessary backtracking. Like sure. this dungeon does have backtracking. Like I spent a fair amount of time exploring between rooms, because there are a lot of rooms where they have like elevated walkways and stuff mm-hmm. that you can only get to from a higher door. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there's a fair amount of that, and that's fine. I like having to do that. What I think probably would have annoyed me is if raising the water level in one room made it so that I was unable to
drop down to the lower level.
Yeah. Or it's like I wasn't able to get back to that room from the way that I previously went into without going back in another way and messing with the water level. Like, I'm glad I didn't have to do that.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, yeah, I think the useful, purposeful backtracking by way of you have to go to a different room to get the key to then go back and open another door. That's very standard levels of backtracking in a dungeon. And I did not find that in any way overused or obnoxious.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that they give you this little the walking bomb enemy to break open the floors in case you didn't have the bombs or the hammer.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was a very cool design decision, so that you really only had to have the hookshot. And if you didn't happen to have, like, if you died and lost those items, you didn't have to go back to Ravio to rent them so that you could bust open the floors. Like,
right,
I thought that
right.
was a cool little easy insert to make that a more accessible place.
Yeah, I agree. Because I don't think anybody would have enjoyed doing that, right?
Right. Like, it would suck to, especially if this is your first dungeon in Lohrule, it would suck to die and not have any of your items, and then you're screwed, right? Like, hopefully at that point you have bought the hookshot, hopefully. But they're making it more less punishing to die.
Yeah,
because of that.
So going back to the hookshot, we've already mentioned one of the main mechanics that it has in this level, which is, using it to grab onto chains that you can pull, and that, you know, does things. And then it works the same with the water level levers. Right. The other one, and I'm curious to know how long it took you to figure out that you could do this. The other thing that the hookshot does in this dungeon is it pulls you to plates on the wall.
Yep.
Which you can then merge into. And it's an easy way to give you wall merging access to move around on a level of the dungeon that you don't have the water raised to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to remember if in previous playthroughs whether or not this was something that I spent a few minutes trying to figure out how to do. This time around, I just sort of remembered that that's how it worked. But, you know, people, the guests that we've had on the show and people in the Discord have said that there have been times in this game where it took them a minute to remember that wall merging was even like a thing that they could do in a given situation, right?
Yeah, I think that I figured it out after one shot, so I don't think it was too obtuse, mostly because they did the very smart thing of having the hookshot plate, right, where it's a little metal plate on the ground that's got the hookshot symbol.
Yeah.
Pointing the direction that you want to shoot it at. So, and also the plate that's on the wall, or the I guess it's a plate also. The plate that's on the wall looks very visually different from the normal wall.
Yeah, it's got that little notch in it, right? Mm-hmm. That it's like,
yeah, and it's got a diamond on it. It looks almost like a target. So they do a good job of telegraphing that. It only took me one try just because I got the timing wrong. I didn't realize that it would smack me up against the wall and then I would have like half a second before I dropped down. I honestly thought that it would just catapult me into the wall and wall merge me automatically, but I figured out very quickly that, you know, you grapple to it, smack, and then A to wall merge and then mush your way around. So I thought that that was a good mechanic that they introduced here, and I hope it gets used elsewhere. Just because of the way the item mechanics work in this game, I doubt that it will, but I thought it was good. I thought it was a good use of the item.
If you're listening to this and you're, you know, engaged on our socials or in Discord, and this is something that confused you for any length of time, please let us know, because I'm very curious to know if this was a cause of like some frustration for anybody trying to figure out that this was a thing that you could do. And it only really happens in a few rooms. Like, it happens toward the end of the dungeon. But I think it's a fun little mechanic, and I'm always down for the main item that you have to use being utilized in several different ways
for
in
sure.
a dungeon. You know, and this definitely falls under that category. I wanted to ask you real quick, were there any keys in this dungeon that you kind of beat your head against for a minute before you figured out how to grab it?
No, not really. I think there was one that I had a little trouble with, that you have to hook shot from a diagonal direction, just because I'm not necessarily used to being able to aim diagonally in a top down. But I quickly remembered that you can do that in this game.
Yeah.
And boom, got it. So yeah, that was really the only one.
The reason I ask is because there's one key in this dungeon that I do always spend about 5 minutes forgetting that I can just grab. It's the one that from a walkway, you just hook shot the key and bring it to yourself.
Yep.
And it's such a simple thing. Like, we know that the hook shot can grab stuff. It grabs rupees and hearts and monster guts and everything, you know, all the time. But because this key is on an elevated platform within the room, I didn't think to hook shot it immediately, just because my mind immediately went to thinking like, oh, I have to get this by raising or lowering the water, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And then, of course, like, a little exploration reveals that there's no lever for that in this room. And so once you kind of make it past that, and you're like, you've got a door that you need a key to, and you're like, okay, I can see on the map where this key is. I can physically see the key. There's no lever. Oh, duh. I've got to hook shot the thing. Such a simple little thing to get hung up on, but I recall this one kind of getting me, not just this time, but it has in the past as well. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of just a little derp-a-der moment on my end of things.
Hey, we all have those every once in a while.
Yeah. Thank you for not making me feel completely ridiculous about the completely easy solution to this getting the key situation.
You're very welcome. Yeah. I only give you a hard time most of the time.
So let's go ahead and talk mini boss and then boss.
Sure.
So mini boss, not much to say here. It's a giant.
It's a big bari.
Yeah, it's a big bari. Not a too super difficult fight. I'm assuming, you know, if you spend the whole time trying to hit this thing with your sword and beating it that way, then maybe this is a little bit more difficult just because of the electricity of it all. But I just kind of peppered this thing with bows.
Yeah, I mean, the upgraded bow shooting 3 arrows at a time kind of makes the big bari especially chump change.
Yeah.
And even then, the little baris, like, I killed almost all of them in 2 shots because they were all just in a ring. So each one of my arrows was hitting 3 of them at a time. So
yeah.
Definitely not a difficult mini boss at all. Yeah, just kind of is what it is.
Just sort of is what it is.
Yep.
Before we
get onto the boss, though, the dungeon item. Blue mail.
Oh, yeah. But it's so funny because I know, like, yes, I made such a big deal early on in this season about, like, yes, the low rule dungeons have dungeon items. They're just not, you know, they're not key items or yeah. whatever, right? And here I am forgetting to talk about it. And also maybe that is just because in the last low rule dungeon,
it was the master ore.
Yeah, the process to get it was, like, such a point of controversy. Right?
And it sucked. Yeah.
This dungeon has also got an upgrade item that you can acquire. It's not Master Ore. It's the Blue Mail, which I, again, did not arrange these dungeons in the way that I did based on what items were in them. But that being said, the blue mail is a really nice thing to get early on in our low rule journey.
Yeah, it's huge for damage reduction, especially for you, like going from quadruple damage to double damage.
Yeah.
Like, man, big deal. Big deal.
Yeah. The puzzle, I think, was actually really well executed, right? Because it's still not super obvious that there's a thing that you can lower the water to get down into.
Right.
Right. Again, you have to rely a little bit on your map. You have to be looking at that and realizing, oh, there's a chest down here.
Yeah, again, the compass being the MVP of dungeon items.
Yeah, and you don't, again, you don't have to have this to beat the dungeon. So I would be willing to bet that there's a, you know, there have at least been some people
who didn't get it.
Just didn't get it, you know? Now, you and I are trying to be completionists as much as possible. So, of course, if there's any chest that we see on the map that isn't open, we're going to make it a point to go try and get it, you know,
especially dungeon chests. Yes. Yeah.
But anyway, I just think that this one was, you know, it's in that nice sweet spot of it's not a gimme chest. Mm-hmm. You know, some thought is still required to get to it, but it's not unfair in any major way. Like the mechanic that. The mechanic that you have to do to get to it, to lower the water, like that lever is sitting right there. It's right in front of your face.
Yep.
And you can see rupees that are down there. Right. So obviously if nothing else, you're immediately thinking, oh, OK, well, I want those rupees. So I've got to lower the water to get down to that, you know.
Sure.
And then cool. Now you're right where you need to be to go in and get.
Yeah.
The
you
mail.
Just go. You just swim right in it. And, you know, with the swimming mechanic in this game being superior to that of really any other top down that I've played, the dive underneath the rolling pin was easy, and the movement works really well, and I thought it was good, and it wasn't overly difficult, and especially for such a key item where you could say like master ore, the upgrading of the master sword is definitely important for doing more damage. There are other opportunities to get other sets of master ore. Like, sure, if you miss that one in the Dark Palace, you won't be able to fully upgrade your master sword, but you at least have the opportunity to get to the second level, right? Whereas in this case, if you miss this, then you're stuck with normal until I assume you find red mail later. But
you find red mail in Low Rule Castle right before the very end of the
game. Yeah, so like you're stuck through pretty much the entirety of the game with taking normal amounts of damage.
Right.
So definitely not something you want to miss. So I'm glad that they made this less challenging than that master ore puzzle.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you for bringing me back around to that, because that is an important thing to talk about. Let's go ahead and start talking about what was it? Argus?
Yes, A-R-R-G-H-U-S.
Okay. Argus, the boss of this dungeon, who, kind of continuing the trend from last week's boss with the Gemasaur King, definitely a more difficult boss fight experience than we had in the early game, and a very appropriately difficult boss for kind of, you know, for low rule where everything is harder, right? Mm-hmm. I would not say that this boss was as hard as the Gemasaur King.
Most definitely not. I didn't even come close to dying in this boss. It's mostly just about staying mobile. And luckily, his laser beam isn't what actually damages you. It's the eruption of water. So as long as you're just constantly moving and staying ahead of it, it's pretty easy to avoid most of his damaging attacks.
It feels pretty frantic while you're doing it, though.
It does. I was moving around the entire time. There was not a millisecond during this fight that I was standing still. Like, even when I was damaging the eyeballs, I was still strafing to one side.
Yeah.
Because as you hookshot the eyeballs, he can sometimes shoot another eyeball at you. Like, the one that glows yellow is not necessarily the one that you grapple. So I was still, you know, moving around and trying to avoid damage from the boss at the same time. So I definitely feel like it was a well-paced boss fight, appropriately frantic. I don't even think he hit me at all, so I'm not sure how much damage he does.
Okay, but he hit me, and I definitely had to chomp down on a fairy.
Quite a lot. Yeah,
quite a lot. Yeah, that laser beam really fried me. I put one foot wrong and got toasted. So
that boiling water will definitely hurt you pretty badly.
Absolutely. I really like, so we have a lot of different versions of this kind of boss in the Zelda series where it's covered in like slime or eyeballs or whatever. And you've got to like yank them off with a hook shot. It's always fun. I think I mention this every time we get to one of these bosses. It's a fun time just because it means that you can't speed through it too quickly, you know?
Yeah.
I will say that I wish that this boss kind of came in two phases where, like, halfway through it reabsorbed its eyeballs again.
Yeah.
You know, just to kind of drag things out a smidgen more.
Yeah. So, like, once you got him half health with no eyeballs, he, like, went back up to the ceiling and dropped back down with more eyeballs.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That brings me to another point. What is it with bosses in Lorule and dropping down from the ceiling? Like, Gemasaur King did it, Argus does it. I'm assuming that this is going to be a recurring theme, and I don't understand. Like, what is the what's the pull there?
They like to make an entrance, Matt.
Sure,
it's dramatically effective.
There you go. They're very dramatic. How about that?
I don't remember if this was like a recurring thing or not, but you know, something we'll keep up with as we go further into this game. I will say the other thing that makes this feel like a more frantic and claustrophobic boss fight than it really necessarily is the fact that the arena is so small.
It's tiny. Very tiny.
Like,
it would have been interesting had the walls been damaging in some way, shape, or form. I don't know if that would have been too much, if that would have been too Mothula-esque. But
I don't know if I want the walls to be damaging, but I do think that in the back half of this fight, maybe adding a few Baris floating throughout the arena.
That would have been fun.
Would have kind of made this fun. Because then, like, not only are you having to dodge the boss and not get hit by the Baris, you're going to want to try and take out the Baris, but also you have to, like, you have the whole... the situation where you can't hit them until they're not electrified, right?
Yep.
So you're kind of juggling several different timed things at once.
That would have been fun.
Could have been fun.
Yeah.
Put that one in the bucket of ways this could have been harder.
Which we love to do.
This is also the point where I'm going to say that the rain has picked up just a little bit since we started recording. And so if you can hear it on the recording, then
you're welcome.
We're not moving unless it gets real monsoon, gale force winds, and torrential downpour out here, but there you go. There's a little rain background noise in the recording for you.
Very peaceful.
Yeah, I think so. Anything else you want to say about Argus before we move on?
Not really. No.
Okay. Good.
Decent boss. He's fine.
We get through here. We pick up the painting of Jackson's favorite character in the game, Christina Bale.
Christina Bale.
Right, exactly. And we get bounced back to the Chamber of the Sages. Not much more to say about this than there was the last time. We get a few words of encouragement, and then it's right back out into Lorule. But it does feel nice to start filling up that room. If nothing else, Gully now has somebody to talk to.
Yeah, so. I like how Gully was still there. Like, in Ocarina of Time, every time you revisit the Chamber of Sages, any of the previous sages you've saved are not there, so it always felt like you were returning to an empty room. I'm glad that they decided to keep the character sprites present, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing that room gradually fill up as we go through dungeons. That's just one of those visual keys that gives you a little burst of dopamine every time you enter it. Like, oh yeah, I'm progressing things. I'm doing what I need to be doing, and I'm seeing a visual indicator of success, and that goes a long way for me. So
yeah,
I like that.
So real quick question for you before we move out of the dungeon map. Now that we've played another water temple, how would you rank the water temples that we've played so far?
Ancient Cistern number one, Ocarina of Time number two, this number three, Angler's Cavern number four.
Okay. I think that's probably about how I would do it as well. The thing is, even though this is a very fun top-down dungeon and the mechanics are executed well, I think that the most successful water temples have got a real sense of mood.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's really tough for any top-down Zelda dungeon to accomplish a very distinctive sense of mood. And that's one of the reasons that I loved last week's dungeon, or sorry, 2 weeks ago's dungeon so much, because the Dark Palace had mood out the butt.
Like, it was crazy.
Yeah, it had a lot of atmosphere, a lot of mood. And, you know, the Water Temple from Ocarina of Time and Ancient Cistern in Skyward Sword both have a lot of mood. Like, they have a very distinctive environmental feeling. And, you know, we'll talk a bit more about that when we get into Twilight Princess with Lakebed Temple, and then Majora's Mask with
Great Bay Temple.
You know?
Yeah, I think the other thing about it is I didn't find this temple overly challenging. And look, I'm not one to say that every temple needs to be as hard as Ocarina of Time's Water Temple. I don't think that that is true. And I don't even necessarily rank Ocarina of Time's Water Temple super highly in my temples overall. Like, it's up there, but it's not top five, I don't think. So, but that being said, if a temple isn't challenging, I don't think that it can be a top tier temple.
I certainly wouldn't call this temple hard.
No.
But what I will say is that if a temple isn't hard, it at least has to be interesting and it has to have some length to it. Like,
for sure,
it can't be quick. I don't want to be just like breezing through these things, you know,
for sure.
And what I will say is that this temple is set up in a way to where you can't just breeze through it, right? Like, you do have to spend time interacting with puzzles, and it is fun for that reason. Even though it's not hard, I do think it's fun, and I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that just about wraps up the dungeon map for us. Let's go ahead and get into part four, which is Bloopy Trails, where we talk about interesting things that diverted our attention this week. And I'm gonna let you go first, Matt.
Yeah, so I collected another 10 Mimis. I am up to like 37, I think. So I upgraded my hammer.
46 for me.
Very nice. I upgraded my hammer this time, so I'm very interested to go use that on somebody.
You're going to be disappointed. It kind of sucks.
Well, that sucks. I opened the Great Rupee Fairy Fountain in Low Rule, and I tossed 400 rupees in there, so I have a couple fairies floating around in there.
What do you get for that? Like,
I had to look it up to ensure that I wasn't wasting my rupees, and if like at like 3,000 rupees or something, you get another bottle.
So, oh, okay. Well, that's worth it.
Yeah.
That's
always so, a good you know, thing to have. I'm definitely not going to toss any more in there until I buy the rest of my items, just because I think that that's more important than a fourth bottle.
Right.
So, but anyway, I'm glad I kind of started down that path. We'll definitely have that as a tertiary priority somewhere along the way. Like I said, I opened the thieves temple or the thieves hideout on accident. I was just kind of running around the thieves village and started getting little snippets of their rhyme. Walked up to the big statue gargoyle thing, and he was like, finish the rhyme after me. And then I was like, oh, cool. So I did that. What else did I do? Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay. So my is for me, for sure. A few heart pieces. I mentioned earlier that I was doing some exploring in Low Rule trying to find something. And so there's a piece of master ore that you can get that is not attached to a dungeon. Actually, there's two pieces of master ore that you can get that are not attached to a dungeon. There's two in dungeons and two out in the world.
Okay.
And one of them, I recalled, was in the in Low Rule's equivalent of the sanctuary. Mm-hmm. And that area of Low Rule's map does not contain a dungeon, and it's not connected to anything else. So you do have to find a dimensional portal that's in that same spot in Hyrule to get there. It's in the back wall of the sanctuary. Yep. In Hyrule.
And I did look this up because I also was thinking about doing some Titan or some Master Ore, and I read that you have to have the Titan mitts for that.
You do, and I completely forgot about that. And so I did not get the Master Ore that I went looking for. But it was a fun little diversion trying to discover a way into a section of Low Rule that I hadn't found a portal to get into quite yet.
Yeah.
It's a nice little thing that they do, to separate it in that way and make it so you can't just kind of like walk there once you're over by Low Rule Castle or something. So even though I didn't get it, it was a fun little bit of exploration that I did. And I enjoyed that chase. We already talked about the stuff with the bomb flower. The other thing that I did was I spent some time messing around with the baseball minigame.
All right. You played a sport, Lyndon. How was your sport?
I didn't enjoy it much more than I enjoy actual real life sports, to be completely honest with you. I really, really wanted to like it because it looks like it could be such a fun thing. Have you played it yet?
No, I have not.
All right. Go play it this week and let me know what you think. But what I will say is that the mechanics around this thing are kind of inscrutable. Like, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to know the correct way to position your bat and your stance in order to hit the ball where you want it to go. It costs a lot of money to play this game. It's 50 or 30 rupees. I forget which one. It's 50. And you get rupees back by playing the game. Basically, the way that it works is that this Octorok pitches you a ball, and you have to hit it with your bat, and you are trying to aim the ball at pots around the edge of the baseball diamond, and each time you hit one, you get a rupee. You can also hit birds that are flying through the air, and those get you 20 rupees. There's a whole system by which, like, if you hit three pots in a row, then a bird shows up.
Sure.
And what you're supposed to be able to do is to chain those together so that you, like, hit three pots, bird shows up, hit that. Hit three pots, bird shows up, hit that, right?
Sure.
And then by doing that, you are supposed to be able to more than recoup your rupees. You know, I think the max you can get in this is, like, 250 or something in one go if you do it perfectly.
Woof.
I played this five times, and I did not recoup my rupee investment any single time. And that was like, it was just so irritating because there's nothing extra to the mechanics of this than what you can just see when you go and play it. The thing tells you that you can, like, you can angle your bat in certain specific ways, mm-hmm. and then that will either shoot the ball higher or lower. But it's just so, so freaking tough to aim this thing correctly. And, like, it's one of those where I don't mind if a minigame is hard, but if I can't figure out the right way to at least be somewhat successful at it after five times doing it, then I don't know that I'm going to go spend too much more time on it, right? Like,
sure.
I want to feel at least successful enough to go back and get better. And to, like, continue kind of grinding at it and get the best possible version of it. But, like, if I'm taking a loss every single time I do it and, like, really putting some kind of energy into trying to do better than
and
that.
And not having fun at the same time.
It's just not working. Yeah. And not having fun at the same time. Then, yeah, I don't know. I think that this is definitely a lot lower down on my list of mini games I enjoy. Definitely below the Cuckoo Run, which at least that's like the Cuckoo Run is hard, right? It's challenging, but it's challenging in a way where it's like there's no mystery in terms of how it works. You just need to get better at it. You know?
Yeah. No, I agree. And I feel the same way about the Rupee Run I recouped my rupees my first time playing the Rupee Run, and I'll probably go do that if I'm ever just, like, low on rupees. But, yeah, I don't know. Games that only award rupees and don't have an opportunity to give you some type of item upgrade or a piece of art or something, I don't generally invest too terribly much time in unless it's just really fun. So,
right. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, that was probably the biggest diversionary thing that I did this week was go and play the baseball mini game, and I don't think I'll revisit it.
Well, there you go.
All right. Let's go ahead and get into part five, which is Z targeting, where we lock on to fascinating characters or enemies that we happen to cross. I mean, options are low this week, right?
Yes. So limited.
OK. So in the interests of, you know, being generous, I'll let you go first and I'll pick one based on whatever you know, whatever's left after you've done yours.
Sure. I will go with Christina Bale this week just because I know that you want to give the you want to do the mad scientist. So,
well, if you did the mad scientist, I was going to do the sentient bomb. So,
sentient bomb would also have been a good one. Fair enough. Christina Bale, I thought was good. It always cracks me up when characters are like, I wish I could thank you. And you're like, I mean,
you could
give me a piece of heart or some rupees or I don't know. Like, the first time we saved her, she was like, I wish I had some way to repay you. And you're like, aren't you the queen of the Zoras? You're probably, like, swimming in gold and rupees. So, like, maybe toss me a hundo or something. Like, I don't know. But, yeah, the whole, oh, I wish I could thank you. It's just so disingenuous.
But I won't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just disingenuous, and you're just genuflecting, and I don't appreciate it. So, you know, find a way to thank me, or don't say that. Like, I'm not asking you to thank me. Just, like, be appreciative. But now you made it about you, and I don't appreciate that. So there you go. Christina Bale.
Fair enough. Well, then, since you didn't take him, I will go with the mad bomb scientist who has a flair for the spoken word, right? He's a very rhythmic way of speaking. I don't know if we're supposed to think, like, are we supposed to interpret this as, like, he's rapping to us? Or is it more like a slam poetry sort of thing?
Ooh, I think I'm going to go with slam poetry just because that's funnier. And I think would be less cringy than a rap. So, or maybe more cringy, therefore funnier. I don't know. Either way, I'm going to go with slam poetry.
Okay. I like that. I like that interpretation. Regardless, you know, one of those fun little characters that, like we said, just has a lot of personality and definitely makes an impression, whether it be a positive or a negative impression, depending on who you're talking to. But yeah, I just, you know, this guy, I get the impression that his life's goal was to create the biggest bomb that he possibly could And by God, he did it. So,
and he somehow imbued it with some level of consciousness. So
there you
good
go
for him.
Yeah, I mean, I guess by that metric, you could even say that he like overachieved on his goal, right?
Oh, absolutely.
He surpassed his whole aim.
And he created a new race. So like, good for him.
Well, that brings troubling moral layers into our destruction of these giant bombs.
But they're all suicidal.
Okay. Are they like infinite?
They are infinitely spawning. So yeah.
Okay. So we didn't genocide anything.
No.
Okay. Good. I would have felt bad.
Yeah. I mean, they're also voluntarily genociding themselves. That's like their point of existence. So
okay,
we're letting them fulfill their purpose.
Cool.
So don't feel bad about it. It just is the way it is.
Good. All right. I won't let it trouble my sleep tonight. Okay. Well, I think that brings us to the end of part five, which means that it's time for Matt's favorite section of the show. Part six, final thoughts, in which he gets to wrap up this section of the game in as succinct a way as he can think to do.
Well, this section of game was probably the shortest section we've played so far. It's just a quick hop, skip, and a jump over to Swamp Palace. While navigating some of Low Rule, we get to interact with some interesting characters and a new semi-sentient species of exploding flowers. So that was always entertaining to see some new characters come across our paths. Lots to explore throughout Low Rule and all the nooks and crannies that we can find there. Moving into a well-executed water dungeon that really showcases again the power and the upgrades that have come with the 3DS, and a well-executed water dungeon overall, leading to a frantically paced boss fight that, while being frantically paced, wasn't overly difficult, and the rescuing of our second sage. Probably the most interesting beat of this game was our little sidebar with Hilda and Zelda, and I think we're very excited to see where those characters go and the journey that happens in parallel to our own.
Yeah. And to that point real quick, you know, we didn't talk about Hilda at all because it is just it's a small little interlude. It's not super impactful, but I love how we do get just a little bit more layering of the story of Low Rule here, where she does, you know, very explicitly state like, hey, at one point, Low Rule was just like Hyrule. And you can kind of tell a lot about her character. She seems very, very put upon, I think, by the state that her kingdom has fallen into. And surely that's going to inform where the story goes from here. We're going to learn more about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I actually texted you this the other day. So I'm getting just serious villain vibes from Hilda, and I don't know why. And I hope that I'm wrong.
It's the red eyes, man.
It is. And like just the way that she was talking to Zelda for most of that little monologue, you know, my kingdom used to be like yours, where all the endings were happy. And it sounded almost bent out of jealousy. And it also goes back to Yuga's dialogue in the first part of the game where he was talking about, I'm sure Her Majesty will appreciate this and you're almost as beautiful as Her Majesty. So it seemed at the beginning, at least, like Yuga was almost in her employ in some way. So I don't know. And again, I don't want anyone to spoil anything for me. I've not beaten this game, so I don't know where Hilda's character ends up. I don't know how this story ends, but I just have my guard up around her and I'm expecting some kind of a twist ending or betrayal there. And I hope that I'm wrong, but that's the vibe I'm getting. And we'll see where that plays out.
We will indeed. We're going to see a lot more of Hilda before the game is over. So put a pin in that one.
For sure.
Alrighty. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the Sacred Realms Rundown. We will, of course, be back next week with another installment of the Sacred Realms Rundown. The detective will be joining us again to talk about the Skull Woods, which, to my recollection, is another pretty fun dungeon. So, going to be a good time.
Absolutely. I remember very distinctly the Skull Woods in A Link to the Past and how it was the most unique dungeon in that game. And really, probably in any game that I've played, where it's just in and out of the dungeon, above ground, underground, going all around. So excited to see what that looks like in A Link Between Worlds.
It was definitely a weird one.
Yes, very weird.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of today's show. Had a good time, Matt.
Always have a good time, Lyndon.
Another water temple in the books. You gotta love when that happens.
Absolutely. We always have fun, even when we're playing water temples.
Even when we're playing water temples. It's so funny because even though this one is called the Swamp Palace, talking about like mood in dungeons, right?
It didn't feel very swampy.
It didn't feel very swampy. It definitely had me kind of pining for the... oh crap! What is this? The Majora's Mask one.
Great Bay Temple?
No, not Great Bay. The Deku one.
Oh,
Woodfall.
Woodfall.
Yeah. Yeah, which is definitely a swamp palace.
This water could have been a little more green.
A little more swampy?
Yeah, a little more swampy.
Okay. Mm. Something that you don't like want to go swimming in?
Exactly. It looked very clean.
Okay.
The water looked very clean for being a swamp.
Cool. Yeah. I shouldn't want to go swimming in a swamp.
No. Alligators in there. Ugh.
All right, y'all. If you enjoyed today's show and would like a little extra Sacred Realms in your life, you can head over to patreon.com/sacredrealmspod and become a patron. If you've got no rupees, it's not a problem. 5-star Apple Podcast reviews are a great free way to support us. More reviews means that more people see our show. That makes us very happy, Hylians. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sacred Realms Pod for updates on the podcast and for behind-the-scenes action. Sacred Realms will be back next Wednesday with our thoughts on A Link Between Worlds Chapter 6. We'd love for you to play along with us and to share your thoughts on our social channels. A Link Between Worlds can be played on the Nintendo 2DS and 3DS family of systems. But in the meantime, may your hearts be full, may your arrows never miss. We'll catch y'all next week. Sacred Realms is an independent podcast production, which is produced, edited, and mixed by me, Lyndon Willoughby. Our music comes from Zelda and Chill by Mikkel and is graciously provided to us by Mikkel and Game Chops Records. Zelda and Chill is available to stream on Spotify or to purchase directly from GameChops.com. Finally, our thanks go to Nintendo for creating such exceptional and innovative experiences.